You're listening to Grant Eden with Focus on Oystermouth Radio. This is Oystermouth Radio's Focus on Mumbles and Gower. It's a regular look at what's happening locally with interviews from those living, working and volunteering in the community. You're listening to Focus on Mumbles and Gower, with me, Grant Eden, and a recorded version of Peter Tremuen. I say a recorded version of Peter because I've used an old recording that Peter completed about a year ago when he interviewed the National Chairman, Alan Richards, of the National Coastwatch Institution. That's NCI at Worm's Head. And I've put that together with an interview that I carried out more recently with Audrey Frank. And Audrey is the new station manager at NCI Worm's Head.
Today we're coming to you from the Coastwatch station, situated at the end of the clifftop path directly opposite the Worm's Head Causeway, which I'm sure many of you will have visited. And Alan Richards, one of the founder members of this station, was actually station manager here for around 4 years and is actually now the national chairman of the whole organization. I understand, Alan, that this is the fifth anniversary of the opening of this station. How long have you, or you know, the various volunteers here, how long have they been working here? And what would prompt a volunteer to actually join? Any idea?
Perhaps it would help if I sketched in some of the history that lies behind this station, because to move straight to the position at Worm's Head would perhaps be a little confusing to your listeners otherwise. Yeah. Back in the late 1980s, perhaps early 90s, there was a major restructuring of Her Majesty's Coast Guard, and that led to virtually all of the old Coast Guard lookout stations around our coast being closed down, and the control of incidents at sea was transferred into a small number of fairly high-tech centres making use of modern technology at that time. This remained the case until 1994, and in 1994 there was an accident off the Cornish coast in which two fishermen lost their lives when their small boat capsized. Now, there had obviously been other accidents in the intervening years, but what was significant and poignant about this one was that it took place close into the shore and right under the windows of an old Coast Guard lookout long since abandoned. The local villagers felt that had that lookout been manned, the probability was that they could have saved some lives. And so they got together enough money to refurbish and re-equip the station, and they got themselves organised into a roster to manage it, to man it rather, and that was when the National Coast Watch Institution was born. The station was Bass Point on the Lizard in Cornwall, and that was in the autumn of 1994. Today, some 17 and a half years later, we have 46 stations operating around the coast of the UK, from Land's End in the west to Sunderland up in the northeast, and several here along the Welsh coast. We currently have some 2,000 or so volunteers manning those stations. and providing a total of over 190,000 hours of surveillance of what goes on our coastal paths and inshore waters at absolutely no cost to the public purse. So that is the background against which this station at Worm's Head was set up, and it opened, as you so rightly say, almost exactly 5 years ago today.
Perhaps I could ask Alan, how is this organisation funded here? Do you have enough funds?
Oh, we never have enough funds, no. The broad picture is that each of the 46 current NCI stations is responsible for trying to raise sufficient funds to meet its own day-to-day running costs. And, nationally, that means that each station has, on average, to raise something between £5,000 and £6,000 just to meet the day-to-day running costs. At the same time, there is a small central cost for administration of the charity, and at the moment we raise that partially through what is called a capitation charge on stations. In other words, each station makes a contribution, which at the moment is around about £20 per head for each of its watchkeepers, into a central pool to fund the cost of managing the charity as a...
Almost like a membership fee.
Almost like a membership fee. We are, at the same time, working very hard at the moment to increase our public awareness and to increase our competence in raising funds centrally instead of relying totally on stations as we do at the moment. And there is in place a national fundraising team which is exploring the possibilities of fundraising from large organisations, sponsorship and issues such as that. But like all charities, at the moment... times are hard and disposable income is shrinking, and the National Coast Watch Institution, like most of the other charities in the country, is feeling the pinch.
How much does it actually cost to run this station?
To run this station, Jeff will have a better idea, but something in the order of £5,000 a year, I think, Jeff.
Yes, of that nature. Yes, it's sorry.
Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely great. Perhaps I could bring Alan back in here. We've talked about the Coast Guard. Presumably you work quite closely with the Coast Guard. Tell us about your relationship with them.
Well, yes, we both locally and nationally work very closely with the Coast Guard. And I think it's probably important for your listeners to recognise that the controlling organisation in all of these search and rescue incidents is, in fact, Her Majesty's Coast Guard. The Coast Guard has at its disposal what they call declared facilities, which in your language and my language means services on which they know they can rely to help them to deal with any emergency. Now, those declared facilities include things like the air ambulance, the RAF search and rescue helicopters, their own mobile cliff rescue teams that Jeff has already mentioned, and amongst those... is the NCI team at whatever watch station they happen to be. And I think it's important that we always recognise that all of those organisations are there at the beck and call of the Coast Guard, and they are there to support the Coast Guard in its efforts to deal with any given emergency. And NCI is no different from anyone else in that respect. In fact, one of our mantras is spot, plot and report, and what that really means is that it is up to us to keep our eyes open to see the danger of a potential incident, or actually witness an incident, to pass the information about that quickly and accurately to Her Majesty's Coast Guard, and then react to whatever Her Majesty's Coast Guard wants us to do. And that is true of all of the other organisations in support of the Coast Guard.
Yeah, so you all work together as one big team.
We do indeed. And as many of your listeners will realise, there is currently a major restructuring and reorganisation of the Coast Guard Service.
Indeed.
And I can tell you that during March, we have now set the dates for a joint working group between the Coast Guard and NCI to identify and define the role of the National Coast Watch Institution in that new structure. So we are very much part of the search and rescue family and are involved in the overall planning.
Yeah, and it's obviously extremely important that that is sorted out. I mean, the safety of everyone in the area, who uses the sea, uses the cliffs, whatever, is very important that this work is properly constituted and, you know, it carries on in the best way.
Oh, absolutely. We have to be quite certain that the systems and, above all, the communication system between the various members of that search and rescue family are sound and robust and capable of coping mm-hmm. with whatever is thrown at them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's coming across to me that you really do a fantastic job here, and I mean that really sincerely. It's such an asset to and a comfort as well for people in this area doing whatever they're doing to know that you're here keeping an eye on them. Well, we come to the end of our time here at the Coast Watch Station, and I'd like to thank Alan and Jeff for your welcome to Oystermouth Radio.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. And I'm sure the listeners have been very interested to learn of all that goes on here. Yeah. Fine.
Can I just...
Yeah, of course.
A moment there on fundraising, because I'm sure Jeff would want people to know that we the Worms Head Station does have its own website. And if your listeners would care to look in onto that website, they will find details there of how to contact the right people at Worms Head.
Well, exactly, because that's what I was going to say. To be involved, people have got to know how to contact you.
And certainly, I have no doubt whatsoever that Jeff and his team would welcome any suggestions from any of your listeners on how they might help, in whatever way, to raise money for the common good.
Quite.
And certainly, I think you would find that the Worms Head website would help a lot in that respect.
So, give us the address of the website.
It is www.nciwormshead.org.uk.
Okay, and presumably they could Google Worms Head.
NCI Worms Head, and it'll come up. Yes. And in fact, I will give you a card that contains the details.
That's excellent. Well, thank you very much for a very interesting time. I've learnt a lot. I'm sure the listeners have. I've got a feeling that we'll probably be back, because I'm sure there's going to be things to talk about in the future as well. But for the moment, I will thank you. Thank you for your welcome, and it's been excellent.
Prophetic words indeed from Peter, saying, "I'm sure we'll be back," because of course that's just what we are now. That interview took place about a year ago with Peter Drimuin talking to Alan Richards of NCI. We now go into the second part of our Focus on Mumbles and Gower interview with NCI, where I catch up with Audrey Frank. And Audrey is now the new station manager at NCI Worms Head, and I was talking to her about the changes that have taken place here at Oystermouth Radio over the last year, and likened it to also to the changes that would have taken place with NCI Worms Head over the last year, making the analogy first that a lot of water has passed under the bridge, or the tide has come in and out a good few times in that last year. The same is true for you, Audrey, as it is for us at Oystermouth Radio. In the last year, a number of things have changed, not least the fact you are now station manager.
Yes, indeed. And I took over in the summer
which is our very busy period. And that's when we get masses of visitors and people falling about and breaking things and getting... We hope they won't be getting stuck out on the worm, because we have this system for trying to alert them to the dangers of the causeway. The causeway is not a causeway to begin with. It's just rocks.
And it's not like the causeways that we see at St Michael's Mount, where you can actually drive a car over there.
Or Holy Island, where you drive a car.
It's much more like you scramble over the rocks almost on your hands and knees.
Right. But even at Holy Island, they get stuck in their cars and their pictures of them standing on the top of them. But in this case, yes, it's a scramble over rocks and a little bit of easy beach in the middle and then more rocks. And people slip and bash their heads and break their legs.
It's recovering them from that position that causes a great deal of problem then.
That's the difficulty. We're there to either take the messages from the public saying there's somebody down there and they've fallen down, or to see ourselves if people get into trouble.
So what do you do when that occurs, when there is somebody in trouble?
We have to phone the Coast Guard, and they put in train whatever rescue services are necessary. And generally the chain of command then is that they get the local cliff rescue Coast Guards to come out and assess the situation.
Because there is a cliff rescue team based at Rosilly, isn't there?
Yes, based is pretty loose, because they're all farmers and workmen and residents.
Of course, it's volunteers, isn't it? Yes.
It's volunteers.
Well, they're a volunteer
sort of
organisation, aren't they?
Yes, connected with
the Coast Guards. All have a main job.
Yes, that's right. Never mind. They come out and assess the situation and decide which emergency service needs to be called after that. And either we get involved in the alerting of what's going on. We monitor the situation if we are needed to do anything in the way of communication.
From the hut you have there at the end of Rosilly, you may see either the cliff rescue team initiate the rescue themselves, or call in one of the inshore lifeboats that have come out there, or possibly even one of the helicopters.
Either that or one of the helicopters, and because there's the air ambulance on back at Swansea Airport, or else there's the military helicopter that comes across from Devon, which is quite quick.
Just across the Bristol Channel, and it obviously will get there far quicker than getting an ambulance out from the likes of Morriston or something like that.
Yes, indeed. Oh, it's almost impossible to get a land ambulance.
As you say, the busy period, of course, is the summer when all the tourists are there.
All tourists are there. The ambulance has traffic to contend with, and then simply getting into the car park is quite a problem, because there are cars all over the place. There's not much room for them.
So, well, you have a little bit of a double whammy there, because you not only have the Gower roads to contend with, which are not built for speed, you have the tourists on there, which in many cases they don't want to speed. They're here to look at the beautiful scenery.
But
even in the poorer weather, you have problems on the Gower Road, so I know that you've had issues even getting your own staff into the volunteers' huts, and you haven't rely upon the goodwill of those who live near.
That's right. I wish we hadn't got on to that this early in the interview, because since Christmas, there have been so many mornings that have started with a phone call to me saying, flood alert. People can't get in and people can't get out. Rosilly is cut off entirely. You can get through to Skerlidge and with difficulty to Port Einan and Horton. But once the floods are between Rosilly and Skerlidge, that's the end of it. And that means it isn't only us and our volunteers, it's also Meals on Wheels, people going into work, children going to school. That is an issue, and that is being taken up. So we'll leave that for now, because
I can see that.
That's a long story.
That one can run and run.
That can run and run. Yes. And we've had 2 days without rain. It's absolutely amazing.
It has been awful over the last a number of months actually, but it has been awful over that period. And of course that. Yes, whilst it might cut down the amount of tourists there, you still have the intrepid walkers who come out there and walk past and want to walk over to the Worm, because very little stops them.
Yes, that's one of the amazing things of being out there. Even on the foggiest, coldest winter's day, there'll be somebody out there in shorts, often with boots, proper walking kit, except they're there in their shorts. There's always, on any day, if the causeway is open, people will go across to the Worm. And some days, of course, they disappear from view, because if it's foggy, you can't see where they're going. But they go out force 9 gale, horizontal rain, stomping out to the Worm, because it's very exciting when you're out there, and it's very atmospheric.
You were saying there's a system you have now in alerting to people to the dangers of the causeway that isn't a causeway.
We have our notice boards, which we put up every day, and we put up the times when the causeway opens and when it closes, and we do tell them an opening and closing. Somebody did say, why do you open and close it? It isn't like that. It's the tide coming in, the tide coming out. And the difficulty is, for many people, not the intrepid walkers, but the visitors, is that they've probably possibly never seen the sea before, some of them. We have visitors from all over the world. And even if they've seen the sea, if they come from inland America or inland Europe, or if they come from the Mediterranean, which has no tide, or from the Baltic, which apparently is the same, they simply can't believe that there's such an enormous displacement of water, which is about sort of 10 metres. The Bristol Channel has the second highest tidal rise and fall in the world, after somewhere in Canada called the Bay of Fundy.
That no doubt catches many of them out, because you mentioned the Mediterranean, and the tide will go in and out perhaps a foot.
Yes.
And so if the land is there when you walk out across it, why isn't it there when you come back? So the people that get stuck out on the Worm, are they in the main foreigners, or people just not experienced?
No, not necessarily. There have been many British people, maybe from, let's be kind, inland Britain, but who don't see the notices or choose not to see them. But we have to have pictures of what it looks like with the tide in, which is an island where the Worm is, and tide out when there's the causeway. And people simply don't believe it. It takes a lot of persuasion. And we do have to do a lot of persuading and a lot of chatting to people, because they come in to see us, which is lovely. And we have this big map of the world up on our wall, and we put spots on for where people come from. And they come from anywhere from Hawaii to the Falkland Islands to Azerbaijan to South Africa. It just amazing. And it's very interesting talking to them and hearing their stories and explaining things.
But they all feel they need to visit the Worm, or visit Rosilli, because it has won a number of different awards for... One of them, I think, was the best picnic beach by Wonderloaf or some company.
That's a very weird one. It's quite a long way down if you want to eat your Wonderloaf at the bottom of... Is there a Wonderloaf? My favourite story is a lady from Brazil who came in and she said she had a picture of Rosilli Beach on her calendar, so she'd wanted to come and visit us.
From Brazil?
From Brazil.
I suppose we have pictures of parts of Rio on our calendars,
yeah,
don't we?
Maybe that's what we need to get to.
One of the things you did tell me was, I think you had some visitors from China, or certainly it was a Chinese lady that... possibly mistimed things or possibly fell in the water, but you were able to provide her with a change of clothing.
Yes.
Get her back to the hotel where it was at least warm enough for her to get changed again.
Yes, she was very skimpily dressed and it was a very cold day, and she came in because we've got a very fine fire that keeps us warm, I'm glad to say, otherwise we'd be pretty cold out there. She came in and we have spare clothes and we do have towels and things in case people fall in, but I lent her some kit, and luckily there's the Worm's Head Hotel on their way back, just right by the car park, so she was able to drop things in there. Another occasion, when a dog fell over the cliff, we lent the people some binoculars to go back down to the beach. It was a fairly alarming occasion because they first came in dripping with water, even having walked all the way from the beach and back along out to us. They had been swimming under the cliffs because their dog, they thought, had fallen over. They didn't even know where it had gone. They turned round and it disappeared.
Again, this is a case of a dog not on a lead, I suppose.
Not on a lead, yeah. And I think a thunderstorm or something, and turned round, no dog. And so they'd been searching and searching. And then they had showed us where they'd been climbing down the cliffs to look for the dog.
And it was horrendous. What appear to be paths, but in fact
they're sheep tracks.
For the mountain sheep, which are tremendous climbers, far better than we are.
But even they occasionally get stuck, and we get people coming into the lookout saying, oh, this sheep stuck on this ledge. Then we phone the farmer, and generally by the time the farmer comes, the sheep has gone back up. But the sort of classic situation is if dogs are off leads and chase sheep, and there have been a lot of sheep deaths out there because they've either been chased over the edge or they've had their throats ripped out by dogs, which is pretty alarming.
The dog that disappeared...
That was a tiny dog.
Ah, right. And you lent them the binoculars?
Oh, sorry. We lent them the binoculars. They went back down to the beach and eventually they saw the red harness that the dog was wearing because it was a sort of a brindle dog and disappeared against the cliffs. They caught sight of the red harness, were able to get up high enough to get this dog down, and then they put the binoculars back in the hotel, and the hotel very kindly, the Worm's Head Hotel, will kindly let us leave things there.
So you've got a regular run of visitors dropping into the Worm's Head Hotel.
Well, it doesn't happen all that often, but it's very handy when it does.
One of the things you also told me was that you went to the Houses of Parliament with Coastwatch.
That's right. We went to... I think Alan has talked about how to raise awareness of NCI. There weren't very many of us, about a dozen, and we... There's a sort of a suite off the main hall where drinks and nibbles are produced, and we had a list of MPs and influential people who flowed in and out, and we would do much what we do in the hut, in the lookout. We just told them about Coastwatch and where we were and what we did and what it was there for. And it was very interesting, but one of the most interesting things was on the wall there were these two sort of lights, square lights, and one was red for the Lords and one was green for the Commons, and every now and then one of them would light up and they'd have to go off for divisions. It was very exciting.
And did you meet the... I mean, you weren't... you were the sole representative of NCI Worm's Head there.
Oh, yes.
And did you meet the local MP for Gower?
Yes, and he said that he was going to come and see us. It occurs to me that he hasn't yet. So,
right.
Martin Caton, if you're listening, we are looking forward to seeing you.
It will be very interesting, because Martin Caton and I were both from the same town. We were both born in Bishop Stortford. And we went to different schools together, if that makes sense. It does to me, because I know the way I'm saying it. But we were at school at the same time, but in different schools.
How interesting.
So, yes, Martin Caton, although he's now my MP for Gower, it's really interesting.
He's a local boy?
Yes, he's a local boy to me, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it would be really interesting to for Oysmouth Radio to get hold of Martin Caton as well.
Yes, well, I think he must have got the message by now.
So, I mean, we started off the conversation with saying that there's been a number of changes, and has there anything else happened over the last year that comes to mind?
Well, I looked back in my diary to see, because I've been very busy, and one of the first things people said to me when I became the station manager is, you must delegate, which I've been frantically doing ever since. But then I looked for my diary, and with the week after I took over, we went to the Gower Show, where we have a stand, and that also is raising awareness. We don't sell anything, or we just stand there and talk to people. A lot of our lives are spent talking to people.
And a lot of my life is spent talking to people as well. Yes.
Well, it's great. That's the way to do it. So that was the Gower Show. That was rather rainy. Yes. They haven't been lucky recently. The week after that, we had an exercise with the Lougher Inshore Lifeboat. And an exercise means that we stand on the cliffs with our binoculars. And the lifeboat put down orange buoys. I'm not quite sure. Somebody puts down orange buoys to simulate people in the water. Well, they're quite big buoys, but they're very difficult to see from up on the cliffs.
Yes, they're very high cliffs down there,
aren't they? Yeah, and our job is to communicate with the boat, to say left hand down a bit.
I suppose everything is easy when you have a glassy sea, because from their boat they'll be able to spot the buoy themselves. But once you get a little bit of rise and fall with the waves...
Well, when we did it with the Horton lifeboat the previous time, the sea had come up and the wind had risen. And they were tied, never mind the orange buoys, you couldn't see the lifeboat from where we were. It was pretty alarming. And it just shows what brave people they are to go out in these tiny little ribs.
And you can see the need then for some sort of system to prevent people from trying to cross the Worm when the causeway is flooding, because to be able to spot them whilst the sea is like that must be very difficult.
Yes. Well, we very much hope that they don't even try to paddle. We have difficulties. We've got an enormous megaphone that if we see somebody taking to the water in any form, we get this megaphone out and blast it at them. And it does cut through most wind and waves and things, but even so, occasionally people come through up sort of thigh deep, and by then the water's moving very fast and back and forth because it's coming around both ways around the island.
So
it's very dangerous.
Forms of riptide across there.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, obviously, one of the people who was stranded out there was Dylan Thomas, wasn't he? Famously, he managed to get himself caught out there. Whether or not it was drink related, we don't know. But there are stories of him being left on the...
They do say, yes.
And you weren't there then, of course.
Well, could have been.
So for the last, it'll be 6 years now, the Worm's Head Coast Watch Station has been in force. And does this mean that you now have sufficient volunteers and sufficient funding to continue, or is that something you're always looking for?
We like to have about 50 watchkeepers. At the moment, we're somewhere near the mark, and luckily we have seven excellent trainees on their way. A couple of them are nearly full watchkeepers, and then there's a third one who nearly is, and there's several doing training, because we do a lot of training, a lot of chart work, and radio training and things.
That's something I could do with radio training.
Sorry?
That's something I could do with radio training.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's a different form of radio, I think, isn't it?
Yes. But we're always looking for good people, and they can come from any walk of life. We Our membership come from farmers, telephone people. We do have one Royal Navy member and several Merchant Navy members. So some of our people have maritime backgrounds. Yeah. It's not necessary. They can be teachers, they can be, as I was, a classical musician's manager. It have nothing to do with the sea, but you can do your charts and learn your systems, and away you go.
And as far as fundraising is concerned, I mean, every little helps, I suppose. And I've noticed that there are not only just at the hut where there is a collection tin out there, but as I go around at various cafes and shops, certainly around Mumbles area, we
particularly
see them
around
there.
The Mumbles area and in the marina, we have our boxes. Areas. But then we do have the occasional event, like in September, I think we had an open garden combined with cream teas fundraising. Or something we do quite regularly is go along to the Pennard produce markets and just do refreshments and pick up what money we can.
That's it's a very good way of doing things, isn't it? It's all providing the refreshments or something like that.
Yes, yeah. and it's always meeting more public and increasing awareness.
Yeah. Well, Audrey, thanks very much for your time in updating us as what's been going on over the last year. And you never know, we could be back again next year to find out what's happened in 2013.
Next installment.
Yeah,
that will be
okay.
Very nice.
Thank you very much, Audrey.
Okay.
This is Oyster Mouth Radio's Focus on Mumbles and Gower. It's a regular look at what's happening locally with interviews from those living, working and volunteering in the community.